Up next from the Center for Social Innovation, Curtis Carlson, President and CEO of SRI International, discusses promoting entrepreneurship at home and abroad with a panel of experts at a Hoover Institution conference.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation.
We have a perfect group of panelists to discuss the next topic. These are all folks, when I go through their bios, you'll see who have actually worked on the issue of creating innovation and entrepreneurial ecosystems around the world. And I think all of you have been entrepreneurs. I think that's another common trait of these folks. These are all practitioners who then transitioned that deep knowledge to make a bigger impact on this really critical and important issue around the world. Suren Dutia is the Chief Executive Officer of TIE, the Indus Entrepreneurs, the world's largest nonprofit organization. They promote entrepreneurship globally. He has been the CEO of several high-tech companies, and he's also worked both in the government and the nonprofit and public sector as well. He has an MBA from the University of Dallas in Texas, so he brings the Texans would probably feel like they're the only ones who can compete with Silicon Valley when it comes to entrepreneurship, and you might want to tell us a little bit about that. Carl, you just met Carl. Carl is the president and CEO of the Kauffman Foundation, who's our sponsor today, and we ought to thank Carl for putting this together. Carl and Richard. He was a professor at Johns Hopkins before he took this responsibility. He's been the chairperson of the Department of Commerce's Measurement of Innovation, 21st Century Economic Advisory Council. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also formed four companies, being an entrepreneur. And he writes prolifically on the topic of innovation and entrepreneurship. And I can speak personally that he has transformed the Kauffman Foundation in an interesting way. One, by bringing it back to its entrepreneurial roots, and the second is by updating it to be fully responsive to the challenges of our time. And as you know, they're the leading innovation and entrepreneurial foundation in the world. And they've made transformational contributions to how we think about how do we create entrepreneurs and how do we move forward. Bert van der Vaart is the co-founded SEAF in 1989, and he became the CEO and president in 1997. Under his leadership, they've made nearly 300 investments and invested more than almost $500 million in over 30 countries. So he, too, gets to see very broadly what's been going on around the world, and he brings that knowledge to us. He was a consultant at Bain & Company. He has a law degree from Yale, and he was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University a number of years ago. Paulo Verdes is the managing director of Endeavor Brazil. Endeavor Brazil is another enterprise that's devoted to promoting entrepreneurship to transform emerging economies. So he has also seen very broadly what's going on in the world. He's been a founding member in two companies, and some of them very large companies turned to be very successful. He started out as a mechanical engineer, and he got his MBA from INSED. So I want to thank the panel for joining us. Again, I think they have the kind of global perspective on innovation and entrepreneurship we need. Just a couple comments. You know, when we think about innovation, because we, like you, work around the world, and we think this is the best time for innovation ever. Every market segment is open for major transformational innovations, whether it's energy. In spite of what our politicians say, we really don't have the energy technologies that we need at cost, so they'll be effective not only here in the West, but in the developing world. Obviously, health and medicine is going through the biggest transformation ever by going from physiology and anatomy and chemistry and physics to an information technology. And you can go down the line, basically, every major market segment is open to enormous transformational innovations. The question is always, well, how do we do that? How do we facilitate our environments and our people and our educational institutions to be more effective at that? And our panel, again, has had enormous experience at making that happen. So the first question I'd like to ask all the panelists is, first, what does it take to create innovation in your experience, successful innovations within the ecosystems that you've worked in?
First, I would like to acknowledge, I think there are a couple people in this audience who are incredibly more qualified. The founder of TIE, Kanwal Rekhi, and a gentleman who has been a tireless supporter of ours, Bill Draper. All of you already met Bill, and you'll soon hear Kanwal. TIE has an interesting model, and in some ways, I think I have enough scars to talk about it since I was involved in starting a couple chapters while working as a CEO of a company on the West Coast. It's based on developing and building entrepreneurial ecosystem. Today, TIE has 53 chapters in 12 countries, and we achieve the mission of fostering entrepreneurship through three pillars: mentoring, networking, and education. So what TIE does is we provide a platform to aspiring entrepreneurs to interact with successful entrepreneurs. We provide the culture of risk-taking, which was just mentioned by Secretary Rice. We give confidence to aspiring entrepreneurs to interact with other successful entrepreneurs who have made mistakes along the way. We make it possible for them to meet other entrepreneurs where they have business synergies and similar interest. We make connections by their networking with individuals who have started similar businesses. We connect entrepreneurs with mentors, which is one of the most important part of TIE's entrepreneurial ecosystem, where we have about 2,500 individuals across the globe who are all successful and accomplished. And this is their commitment because they are committed to this concept of virtual creation of wealth by giving back. We make it possible to connect chapters with each other. So if you are in Silicon Valley, you have a window to the world by connecting with 52 other chapters. Last week, I started to look at what's happening, and I looked at one particular situation which stared at me. Lahore, Pakistan, a chapter that I have worked with. And I was looking at what they have been doing, and I was pleasantly surprised that in the last 12 months, they have incubated, or they are in the process of incubating, 9 startup ventures. So in my judgment, it is possible to cultivate the culture of entrepreneurship, and that's how we do it.
Paul?
Well, Endeavor is also a nonprofit that supports entrepreneurship in emerging markets. We do have a very strong focus on a type of entrepreneur we call high-impact entrepreneur. I think Richard mentioned that a little bit. So there are some microfinancing operations in Brazil, but Endeavor focuses on the type of entrepreneurs who could eventually become a Google, because we believe that if nobody wants to do it, then it's not going to happen. I think it sometimes sounds too easy, especially being here in the Silicon Valley. We talk a lot about the success stories, et cetera. And it almost seems easy to build such a successful company here. And I mean, it's not. And it's not easy down there as well, in Brazil or in India or in Pakistan or anywhere else. And I think part of the issue of fostering innovation is getting to realize that entrepreneurship is a very long-term thing, and it's hard anywhere in the world. So we don't really take it when people say, well, if we were doing that in the Silicon Valley, then it will fly really, really fast and it will be easy. And there's a line of venture capitalists wanting to fund your business. I mean, even if you take Google or Skype, it was not easy to fund them. And we had a nice chat with the Skype founder, Niklas Enström, a couple of years back. We took a couple of entrepreneurs to talk to him. And he said, well, maybe if I had started Skype in the Silicon Valley, I wouldn't have gotten funded. And his rationale for that is that there was no competition for money. There was very little money available where he was starting the business. But there was no competition for that money. It was very, very easy and fast to assemble a talented team. And it's very, very hard to do that in the Silicon Valley. Of course, you have a lot of people. But there are a lot of companies fighting for that talent pool. And then, well, there's also a friend of mine came to Stanford, took an MBA, and then he started a company, got funded. And then 2 years down the road, he realized that two other companies had already been funded a year ago to do the same thing. He called investors and gave the money back because he says, I could never, ever make up for this one-year loss that we had. And in emerging markets, we don't have that. Of course, the regulatory system is very, very bad. The taxes, there are a lot of hurdles. But there are some that exist here and do not exist there. So I think it's really important for people to understand that it's difficult anywhere. Be successful is a tough thing. And then I think one of the things that Tide does and we also do is we focus a lot on the role models because we believe that, especially in emerging markets, we talk about the oligarchs and et cetera, but there are not very close role models that people, young people or even older people, can relate to and say, well, I can be this guy within 5 to 10 years. And we figure it's really, really important to have that. So just to give you an example, there's one of the companies, we currently support 45 companies in Brazil and more than 300 around the world. And the support is mainly through mentorship, advice. Sometimes we bring MBA students to work in that company for a summer job. One of the companies that we support was created by a very, very poor woman who lived in a slum, had no education, had a black skin, of course, no money whatsoever. And she was very, very unpleased with her own hair. And then she said, well, I need to fix this. And she said, she put it that way, I need to find a husband and I need to find a job. So I need to fix my hair first, otherwise I'm not going to get any of the other two. So she didn't intend to build a company. She just wanted to fix one real problem. So she was the first customer for what she created. She spent 10 years mixing stuff in her own bathroom till she found something that worked. And then she was happy. That's what she wanted. It was a very innovative solution. And then other people around her community started asking, well, can you do it for me as well? So then her husband sold the VW Beetle, which was all they had, and bought some stuff, and then they started treating hair for other people. Well, that was 13 years ago. Now they employ 1,000 people in Brazil. They've been doubling in size every year. And this woman became such a reference for the rest of the country because she proved it can be done. So I think this is really, really important. So it's an innovative business, had no money, had no education, had no network, had nothing, but she went out and did it. So it's really an attitude thing that we have to work. And last year, through an initiative from Kauffman Institute, Kauffman Foundation, we had Global Entrepreneurship Week, which was a platform to promote entrepreneurship worldwide. And in Brazil, we set a very, very aggressive target. They had done it in the US, and Gordon Brown had done it in the UK. And they had sort of gathered 500,000 people to participate. So we figured, well, we're in Brazil, it's a big country, we need this, et cetera. So our goal for the first year was to create the biggest one. And then we set out to involve 500,000 people. In the end, we got 1.5 million. We got a huge campaign that was donated to us, around $10 million in terms of ad space, primetime TV, newspapers, magazines, radio shows, everything. And then a lot of coverage as well from the reporters. And we ended up touching more than 50 million Brazilians exactly with this message that entrepreneurship is possible, telling stories, getting examples to TV, Brazilian examples. We even got Michael Dell to film a short clip saying how he started Dell. And I think it had a tremendous impact in the country. Because once you break that mindset that it's not possible, then you create a different road that leads you to how can this be done? And then you can achieve entrepreneurship all around the globe.
Right. Thank you. Carl?
Kurt, you know, I'm going to start by asking the audience a question. You don't have to answer, but this is sort of a rhetorical question, okay? Is every company an accident? Somebody's already said yes, okay? And every successful company is a happy accident. Now, the must be a venture capitalist over here. I think the right answer is yes, it's an accident. And there are a lot of naturally occurring accidents, thank God. And the Secretary of State has just suggested to us that which most of us know. More of these accidents seem to happen on a per capita basis in the United States. Now, what we know about entrepreneurship, I would suggest, is precious little. And I'll give you a couple of examples that should shake your faith in what we know. At least they shake mine. First, we don't know who becomes an entrepreneur. There's no psychologist can tell us. There's no instrument that tells us. Now, there are venture capitalists who say, I shake hands with somebody and I can tell right away. Okay? Okay. And see, the smoke's still coming out of my gun. Right? Well, you know, the reason that the Kauffman Foundation focuses on what it does is because this is no longer a society that can sort of depend on happy accidents. Entrepreneurship has become central to what our economy is. Most economists don't get this, and I'll talk about this a little later. But if this is central to our growth, we actually ought to be a little bit more systematic about it. Now, the second place I want to take you is to have your faith shaken, right? Everybody in this room knows the extraordinary certainty of venture capital investing records. As a limited partner, I know that GPs tell me with great pride that they'll invest in 10 and they'll have one great home run. And two or three will limp to the finish line and five are total wastes. And there's a sixth, I guess, because I want to make sure everybody knows that I know how to count to 10. Then we know that everybody knows that only 8 out of 10 firms started will be alive in 3 years. So if this is so really important to us, who's the professor of business anywhere in the world, but let's just call it the United States, who's written a paper, a single paper on how to improve success in startup firms? They don't care. What they do for the most part is tell stories. They tell stories. They tell stories. They tell stories about how firms are started. Now, if this is so important to our society and its economy, maybe it's time to move on to sort of science. Last point. There are three universities in the United States that have a PhD in entrepreneurship. I won't say anything further. Okay, can you imagine what the canon is that they teach? If we don't know how to if we don't know who they are, if we don't know how to improve success, let alone if we know nothing about how to scale a startup, which nobody knows, except of course 500,000 or 700,000 venture capitalists, okay, who actually tell you they know, but it's always after the fact, and they refine very carefully what firms they're going to talk about. Okay, all right. And I want to say very quickly, before anybody gets their hackles up, I am a limited partner in venture funds, okay? And I'm an angel investor in 4 companies right now, okay? Venture capital is critical to our growth. But with all these other questions around, we actually ought to have some more science in the world of firm starting that should inform even firm investing. Now, last point. The two gentlemen to my left proceed happily and to great social benefit with not having to puzzle through these questions. Because what they do is they find the natural accidents that are occurring and they actually have systems to improve success. This is fantastic. This didn't even exist 25 years ago. Okay? This is really important because what it does is propagate the notion through Endeavor and through TAI that what happens here, be it in the Silicon Valley or in Austin or in Madison, Wisconsin or in Route 128, can be propagated around the world. But we have still fundamentally, Kurt, to get to the question of, okay, how do we make a more innovative society? And I would submit that unless there's somebody around like the Kauffman Foundation who's agitating in the research departments, who's pushing these questions, you know, the Kauffman Foundation, running the Kauffman Foundation is not to be everybody's happy partner. There are presidents of universities who don't want me to show up. I look like the Undertaker, right? Because one of the first questions I'm going to ask them is, how good is your technology transfer office? How come you can't get those marooned ideas into commerce? Why are you trying to enslave a professor? Why are you trying to establish a priori a value on an idea that has no value unless it becomes a company? Okay? We ask those questions out of the perspective that there has to be an entity that keeps stimulating underneath very, very troublesome questions. To the point, the whole point of this is to, in fact, increase the number of people who do this, increase the number of people who do this successfully, increase the number of people who do this successfully at scale, not only to their own benefit, we're totally Adam Smithers, but the real reason a foundation exists to do this is to, in fact, advance the welfare of all. That's it.
Good. We'll come back to that.
Wow. Okay, well, I was going to start off and say that I'd been trying to find up something to do with my hair, but I didn't get to the 10-year. It all blew up before I got that far. But I've certainly been involved with a lot of accidents. I guess what I want to talk about, certainly, and every one of these are silos of thoughts, which I know we will synthesize during the remainder of this panel. But I think what we have done, as you ably pointed out, is invested in small, medium businesses in 30 countries around the world, which does give you a little idea about what it takes to succeed and what the conditions, et cetera, are in which these people have done it. And one thing I think commonly I can say, we've been up for 20 years now, so it's been a long, long slog. And we grew ourselves out of cash flow, which has probably felt like an even longer slog. But what we can say is that a lot of this is there are bright entrepreneurs. And they're entrepreneurs who see something missing. They may themselves be frustrated, don't have the temperament of working for the World Bank or an insurance company or a real job, as their mothers might have been saying. And so there they are, bending metal, trying to find something to do, an accident waiting to happen, if we talk about the previous analogy. I think that many of them get that product out and they get that revenue going. But to where that innovation becomes successful, what they often don't do is they often are a lot less able to understand how to grow their business, how to get their costs in line, how to work on working capital, because they see that mission, making everybody's hair look better than mine. They don't really see their mission initially. How do I really cost that down, and how do I expand? Because one of the biggest problems of all entrepreneurs who move into the formal sector, who are in many cases in countries where there is endemic corruption, where the person who's making the sale is often associated with getting the kickback. You know, how do you trust your sales staff? How do you trust your HR, your CFO, from not using what's valuable information and ripping you off? So there's a lack of trust. There's a lack of focus on what the business of commercializing this idea is. We had some terrific scientists in Russia, really brilliant people, but oftentimes they had a sort of a shadowy kind of figure near them who was their business manager, and then these guys would be able to kill ideas faster than the government would. So, you know, it really made it impossible to invest in some of them. So in our view, really, when you get down to innovation, you know, I think the saddest thing, I'm a Dutch guy, we hate waste. The compelling reason for my doing it, I'm not fighting my DNA, I'm just moving with it. But what we see is that you've got great ideas moving, and then they founder. And they founder because the business isn't managed well. People don't understand what the potential threats are. I mean, at this stage, we can look around the world and see a lot of companies hitting the wall. It's a terrific time for consolidation because those companies that have been well managed is able to take market share. So if I'm asking the question, and one thing I would say also, where I think the U.S. will have a permanent advantage for many years, is that people here do understand that management of resources is, in and of itself, very important. It isn't just the bright scientist. It isn't just the bright and slick marketer. It really requires something more. And when you want to go scale, then really that's what you're talking about. Just one last word, and we're talking about an ecosystem of entrepreneurship. We started 20 years ago with a $300,000 grant from AID Out of our money, maybe about 7% still comes from AID, originally, particularly in Eastern Europe. We made money on these grants, and then AID says, my gosh, you know, what are you doing making money on this stuff? What do we do now? And they said, you know, for God's sakes, please put this now not in another fund where you make more money. Do something with it that loses it. And what we did is we went around and we looked and said, well, what was the weakness, if you talk about the growth in the 200-odd SMEs? We've done 290 SMEs now. And it's bench strength, right? Because if you got the accident on the entrepreneur, he or she is pretty much condemned to bumbling forth and succeeding or not. But to scale it out, how do you attract decent people to be their CFO, to be their HR person or head of sales? Because this is not the number one position. They're not the god of the universe. They're actually working for this pretty chaotic kind of individual who's gotten them where they've gotten so far. And that is why we opened up the Center for Executive and Entrepreneurship Development. And I'll tell you, a couple of things. We had a guy from Procter & Gamble who did 28 years with Procter & Gamble before he joined us. He actually did market research. I mean, a lot of these government programs, the EU, I'm sure, never understood what market research is. But they just go out and they say, well, let's just, you know, teach entrepreneurship. And I would say that Carl, even your blistering introduction of how little we know about entrepreneurship is doing more justice than what I've seen from AID programs or from the EU in terms of, well, what is teaching entrepreneurship? Well, we'll just send some professor and he'll talk. And so there's these hapless group of 30 Bulgarians who are going to be, you know, talked at by some professor from Iowa State, and he's going to talk about GM. You know, I mean, I don't understand what the relevance is. And normally what happens after a day or two, people figure out there's no money there, and so the third day there's nobody in the audience. You know, what we did is we actually said, what do entrepreneurs need? And entrepreneurs want to know how to get their products on the shelves of companies. How do they prepare a project that actually is going to stand a decent chance of getting through a tender? That's one important thing. So there's practical training that this does. And the other thing is that they do look for role models. And that's in any society, in any country, there are successful entrepreneurs. How they've gotten there, you know, we can only really praise God. And some of these people, I mean, I would say many of them, and I think the TIE is an excellent example, want to give back after they're successful. They want to mentor. They want to actually work with entrepreneurs who really have nothing really to add to them at all, but just their desire to see people grow. Well, we call that a top class. We found these mentors available in all these countries, and they've really established a terrific network. We'll talk more about networks, but they're now 7,500 entrepreneurs in these seeds in Southeast Europe, and it's just thrilling. I mean, many of them became initially, they thought we might fund them, but the more interesting thing is what's happened since that time. That kind of support, when your wife doesn't know, your mother doesn't know, doesn't want to know, why aren't you working in the government instead of doing this crazy thing with the people, that kind of support is what mentors and networks are all about. And I think that they do encourage the kind of stick-to-itness that together with an entrepreneurial idea or an accident does lead into a successful growth story.
Right. So let me build on the point that Carl made and Bert, your genetic disposition to avoid waste. Carl was actually being kind, I think, about our performance at innovation and entrepreneurship. Even in big companies, you know, the lifetime of the top 500 companies used to be about 100 years before they went away. Now it's down to under 20 years. I love the idea of tech transfer in universities. They call their departments that. Everybody knows that that's the one thing that doesn't work, right? Tech push doesn't work. They even got the name wrong, right? and if you look overseas, yes, there are a lot of companies being formed, and yes, we can tell lots of nice stories of the exceptional person who stands up and does this remarkable thing, but if you look at systematic success, it's hard to find. They form companies, yes, million-dollar companies, not billion-dollar companies. Million-dollar companies won't have the kind of impact that we need in the society we're going into. If you look here in Silicon Valley right now, the entire venture community has been underwater for about 5 years. Where are the successes? And we all agree that if we don't get to be really good at this, we're not going to have the kind of societies we want. So I'd like to ask the panel again, what would it take? What would be the one or two big things that would really help move us forward to be more systematically successful and make an impact at scale?
We have to write better business plans.
Okay, Carl, you start. Carl, what would you do? You study this all the time. What would you do?
Well, you know, one thing that business doesn't do and medicine does, and to great benefit, is business never autopsies failure. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything at all about failure. We just pass along quickly. You know, I just made a joke about this, the business plan issue. It's ridiculous that when we teach, and this year we will be teaching millions of kids, literally, millions of kids, in Kauffman campuses alone, and this is sort of a self-indicting statement, we have about 350,000 youngsters in our Kauffman campuses. Those are just schools we give grants to, so that every kid on the campus has some exposure to the narrative of entrepreneurship in their life. But there are millions of kids being exposed to entrepreneurship but don't know what to do about it. And our systematic way is, you know, they don't have to go to Bulgaria. They can just go to University of Iowa or even fancier universities, okay, and be taught how to write a business plan. There's no sense about how this happened, okay, and there's no sense that we have to do it systematically. And the worst of it is, I don't even know where there's a center of people thinking much about this. Last point might be that to even raise these questions around professors of business, for example, they get all very, very defensive. Venture capital folks get very defensive. They don't want to hear your statistic, mm-hmm. okay? And that's the other firm, not my firm, mm-hmm. okay? But Bob referred earlier, we have a little flapdoodle at the Kauffman Foundation because one of our colleagues, the man who runs all of our money, who happens to be brilliant, wrote a blog the other day. And he was touched off like a rocket when he read that venture firms were looking to the federal government to be declared part of the systemic risk and maybe get TARP money. So I'll apologize on behalf of my colleague who hasn't slept in 15 days. Anyway.
I think I agree with everything that's been said. And there is some science, but there's a lot of drive, attitude. There's a little bit of intuition tied to it. At Endeavor, we have a similar model. We have mentorship. We try to provide them with frameworks. Usually, entrepreneurs in emerging markets, they don't understand the value of having a top team. So they tend to hire people worse than them so that they won't lose their status within the company, et cetera. They don't understand that they have to hire people better than them so that the company will grow faster. So there are a few things that you can teach them. But I think, first of all, we did a survey with the 300 companies that we support, and we asked, how did Endeavor help you the most? And we were a bit surprised because the outcome was that Endeavor helped them think bigger. So if they have more ambition, if they realize that they can do more, they look for the tools to get there. Because entrepreneurs are, by nature, problem solvers. So if they do understand that it's possible, they'll find ways. Well, there's no venture capital. They'll ask somebody. They'll ask a successful businessman to lend them some money. They'll get there. They'll tweak their business model to need less money. With the crisis, for instance, we did a survey with the Brazilian companies. And we found out that a third of them had never used any funding because it was so expensive, and it still is in Brazil. We usually have the highest interest rates in the world. So a small company would pay around 2% a month on a regular loan. So a lot of companies would not even get off the ground if they had to pay back any type of financial institution. So they had to adapt their models, et cetera. Of course, they grow slower because of that. But I think if you really need like key points, you have to make people believe that it's possible, that they do have the opportunity of creating something great, something bigger. Mm-hmm. And then you do have to create a support system to provide them with the guidance, the tools, the education on how to bridge each of those gaps to get there.
So this idea of building spirit and community and knowledge and role models and knowledge. Some countries are now teaching innovation and entrepreneurship from kindergarten all the way through college. Is that the future of education in America to help spread these skills?
Well, I haven't been to to college here, but I have been to a workshop by Tina Seelig, who teaches here. And I think it's a very, very interesting approach in terms of getting people to experience things, getting people to understand the dynamics of running any type of operation, and you can do that at any age. And that has tremendous benefit in terms of getting people more curious about things, getting people more engaged, and getting people to understand that if they do some things well, they'll benefit from it later on. So I'm not sure if this is such a thing as a PhD for entrepreneurship, but I think there are some activities that can be done since kindergarten that will make people better prepared to face an entrepreneurial challenge.
I may be a little slower thinker, so part of me wants to answer the previous question, and part of us is still this one. But I do think one of the things is that I believe if you look at the risk capital side, trying to scale things up, it's not enough. It's important, it does great, but I don't think you find a lot of businesses that are going to go 10 times or 15 times money. So I think one of the issues is, and we're certainly trying to develop this ourselves, is what kind of modified risk capital model can you push out there that would get money out there that isn't perceived to be as expensive, Pablo, as some of the entrepreneurs will look at it at a relatively early stage. It could be debt with warrants, et cetera, but then you've got to really hold on to some of these companies a much longer time. One of the things that's really difficult in the SME world is that the Draper Fisher Jurvetson model, as IFC understands it, you need a 9-year fund, you've got 4 years to get the money out, get 5 years to get it back. Essentially a buyout model almost in a market like the United States that up until recently had a very vibrant capital market. That is not necessarily applicable in Macedonia or in Bolivia. And so when you try to come and you've got companies that have got to go through more hurdles and have got to gain the confidence, et cetera, how do you get more time for them to grow up? And what are your expectations? Let's say, I don't think our expectations should be necessarily that you do risk capital at more than 35% IRR, et cetera, although you have to charge appropriately for the risk. So that's one thing. The other thing I think really is there's too much top down. What I've seen is that really peer-to-peer is a lot more interesting in terms of the authentic, what does it take to succeed? If you're trying to say, how do we promote more of this? I think getting entrepreneurs in to forum where they do talk together, and of course many of these people are extremely busy and they're not into conferences, they're not into lots of meetings, but if you can get them in to where they are able to really talk about their own problems, etc., I think that this really is electrifying. I mean, if you'd want to talk where we see the growth impetus and the ambition, if I'm preaching it, they say, well, yeah, you would be because you're trying to make money off me. But if they're talking to their peers and saying who succeeded, how did they do it, and they really encourage each other. I mean, this top class, these guys meet, over 9 months. It's a group of five, and they're mentored by two guys. And they actually, at the end of that period, become really much more ambitious, because what they've seen is that these mentors have made it, and then they egg each other on. It's not like Alcoholics Anonymous, where they're trying to sort of set, how are you going to be more ambitious? But it has a little bit of that character. Mm-hmm. So I think peer-to-peer and networking, I think, not necessarily just on the Internet, but peer-to-peer is one way to really extend the culture of, hey, we got to go for it. The other thing I think we ought to realize is that we're going to have failures, and we ought to bless failures. I mean, the U.S. has been good at that until recently, I think. But I think certainly creative destruction. I mean, we all have read Schumpeter. I think it's a terrific part of the system. Too few people understand that, and I think we ought to really celebrate that at some stage to say that is an important part of what growth is all about.
You know, we have the happy situation of a huge amount of peer-to-peer support going on. And then the question is, how do you get more people in the pipeline? And I almost dropped out of my chair when you were thinking about maybe public school teachers teaching entrepreneurship. I don't think we can go that route. We believe, obviously, very, very deeply, it's what Global Entrepreneurship Week is about, is just the mere exposure of these stories is a first start. So that every kid Mohammed Yunus has this wonderful line that we're all entrepreneurs, only the lucky of us discover it. And to a huge extent, I think that's probably right. I think back on my own life, I had already started three companies and was mowing the grass on a Saturday, and I think I was over 40 before it occurred to me I'd started three companies. One was publicly traded before it occurred to me. Now, I may be a confession here of how really backward I am mentally, but I had never attached the word entrepreneur to myself, maybe because I couldn't say it. But, you know, that is an informative moment in the sense that what would have been different in my career had I thought at the beginning I was an entrepreneur and then had been able to seek, through a Thai equivalent to what you're talking about, the mentor-to-mentor. I was a professor who was sort of off the reservation, starting a business. I had 16 kids in an office building downtown that I'd personally guaranteed the rent on, okay? You know, suppose I'd had that support. Now, if you roll the tape back, you know, if you look at just the history books in our American schools now, you will find dozens more pages about episodes in our cultural history that are abhorrent. We'll dwell on endlessly on the bad parts of American history, and you can read these books from cover to cover and not see a word about someone starting a business. Thomas Edison has almost disappeared. George Eastman's out of these books. Okay, the whole story of Genentech, just not even told. It's much too complicated to be able to teach that in science. So the mere sort of exposure that this is our common culture and what it means is sort of absent. So in a way, Kauffman, through these projects like Global Entrepreneurship Week and our Kauffman campuses and so forth, we almost think we're doing remediation. What a waste of our money, but it's sort of called for. And in a sense, I think it starts right at the university level down. The way we conceive of entrepreneurship at the university level is this is some cream that rises above the whole class. They'll show up in our laboratories, and we'll identify a couple of them who'll be so smart and so ambitious that they've got a firm in them. And then we'll activate a very elite sort of infrastructure to induce a firm. And, you know, here's a different way to think about it. You know, to come on a campus like this is to run into a jillion smart people, right? But if I were to say to people in the audience, at Stanford, which has the reputation of everybody here is an entrepreneur, is that so? If you go out and ask those kids, are you getting a PhD? Are you going to start a company, right? Maybe 15 in 100 would say, I've thought about it, okay? So we actually probably walk around in a mythological moment ourselves, and we give ourselves a bye all the time in terms of it's going to happen, it's happening, we're here, we're attending it. But the question is, there ought to be tons more of it. And we don't know how to get from here to there because we don't have any science. But we call it Kauffman, the science of startups. We don't know how it happens.
Sir?
Curtis, let me, since we talked about education and kids, we are experimenting with something that I think is pretty exciting. And let me take you outside Silicon Valley. In Boston, we started a youth initiative working with schools. First year, we had 15 kids who volunteered, conditions where the schools won't have anything to do with it. We won't involve parents. This will bring kids with total consent from the parents, and they will not know each other, but they can connect with each other. 15 kids volunteered. It was so successful, we decided to continue. We had 100 kids this year. We had a 13-year-old child in Silicon Valley who has now started a company of his own and selling on Amazon. So this coming year, we have now four other cities have volunteered for us, each saying they will have 100 kids involved. We have a 3-month curriculum on entrepreneurship. Seattle, Carolina, Silicon Valley, Boston will continue, London, and then one other chapter most likely will join in Delhi. So suddenly we'll have 500 to 600 kids involved. And what's been interesting is that these CEOs who function as mentors, we have more interest on their part wanting to work with these kids. Not only that, but what's been especially interesting, that kids who would have been playing around on weekends, playing game, video games and what have you, suddenly they're spending their Saturdays working on these projects, projects that they've jointly identified. And it's been amazing. We haven't had a single kid drop out. So parents are suddenly thrilled that their child, their son or daughter, is participating in an entrepreneurship project, wants to, comes home and talks to parents, talks about accounting, talks about saying that, Dad, if I, will you match every dollar that I save? Suddenly all kinds of, lot of learning is taking place. And it's interesting that suddenly we had from nowhere, and what was interesting is that Carl and his colleagues and I worked on this project. And idea was very simple, that for every dollar that I put in, I have support from Kauffman, now every city, and we have picked five cities, they're all putting their skin in it. So suddenly we have several hundred kids involved in it, and we are ready to launch that. And we are very excited about it because we think that in addition to the education, the entrepreneurship education, a lot will come out of it. Now, since Carl is very proud, and rightly so, for Kauffman deserves all the credit for making entrepreneurship the buzzword universally accepted. Carl, I was in my favorite city last month speaking at formerly the Maryville College of Sacred Heart, now Maryville University, last month. And St. Louis happens to be my favorite town in Missouri where I had most of my education. Carl, I went to office of Tom Eshen and picked up Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations by up to 2015. And there are seven goals, starting with eradicate poverty and hunger, education, empowering women, all kinds of good things here, environmental sustainability, develop global partnership, not one word anywhere on entrepreneurship. So, Carl, it's an interesting project for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to open this up to comments.
Can I say one thing in response? Because yes. The audience may have had a little window into my sort of deliciously desperate view about entrepreneurship and whatnot. It comes, Soren's remarks prompt this. I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs in 2004 about creating entrepreneurial economies. And one person I know for sure read it, his name was Gordon Brown. And to make a long story short, he called the Kauffman Foundation and said, we can't make big companies here, we need more entrepreneurs, would you teach entrepreneurs? But we don't do teaching. And I asked him, why is this? He said, well look, this is what I'm asking you to do. You gotta help us get kids here. I'm gonna call this a reverse road scholarship. I want to pay you, the Kauffman Foundation, to take these kids, and they got to come back and be ready to start a business.
Yeah.
Now, just think about what that says. I'll give you a statistic first. In the United States, we produce 30 to 35 companies every year that cross $1 billion in top-line revenue. In the last 10 years, there have been four in all of Europe and the U.K. They can't grow big companies. The task in front of us, I said yes, but the task in front of us, I didn't appreciate at the time, was we had to teach people who the day they stepped back into Great Britain had their company ready to go. Now, I would submit that's a task that no business school in the United States faces. They don't do it that way. They teach 3 hours of introduction to entrepreneurship. They take 3 more hours of entrepreneurial finance. They teach 3 hours of this, 3 hours of that, okay? But they don't get anybody ready the day they get their diploma to start a business. Mm-hmm. That's not the exercise of higher education in the United States. The people around me here, they're very, very much closer to exactly that task. The happy accidents present into this social network, mm-hmm. and they go to town making that business start or flourish the next day. What's the missing link is between an objective, which might be a millennial objective. The world should have 2 or 3 times the number of entrepreneurs. But we don't know how to go from that millennial objective, if you will, to the point where Thai has, 14 times more people demanding the services of Thai or Endeavor. or your network?
Well, we need to innovate the process of innovation. I would point out, too, that the program that Cern and Carl just described is being replicated all over the United States. Here in Silicon Valley, there's a program called the Girls Middle School, where seventh grade girls write, get there, and run companies for a year. They get them funded by a panel of venture capitalists. They get $100. They run them with folks like us on their board of directors. Just like you said, they have to send a board book every month. And at the end of the year, they break their companies up and they pay back their venture capitalists with interest, of course. They give 30% to charity, they earn social responsibility, and they get to split the rest. And I want to tell you, when you meet these young girls, it is a moving experience because they've been transformed. And, you know, these kinds of programs, to me, are how we're going to really solve this problem. We start educating people from the ground up, and they're are not hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs. We have tens of millions of them, billions of them around the world. So let's have some questions. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Wasik Bukhari. I have an investment company that takes innovations from here to outside the U.S. So I was trained as a scientist, became an entrepreneur, became an investor. You know, in terms of defining entrepreneurship, I would call it a Darwinian selection process in an ever-changing landscape. So I don't think there's probably an analytical way of predicting where it might be successful, but there's one common theme, which is risk tolerance. That's what defines an entrepreneur. So coming back to this question of how and why of promoting entrepreneurship abroad, the question could also be, how can we sustain entrepreneurs by promoting risk tolerance, by allowing them to take risks, especially abroad? Because here in Silicon Valley, we have an ecosystem that allows people to take risks. So maybe if you could address that question, how can you promote risk-taking outside this area?
Paul? I think there's maybe a common misconception that entrepreneurs are risk lovers, and usually they're not. Nobody likes risk. I think the biggest difference for entrepreneurs from entrepreneurs and the rest is that entrepreneurs are very good risk managers. So their perception of risk is quite different. Whereas somebody would face something unknown and say, wow, this is totally impossible, I'll never do that. The entrepreneur immediately attacks that problem, saying, what are the issues here? But if I do this, if I do that, if I bring this person along, he's always thinking about how can I reduce the risk levels, and he does that almost instinctively. So it's not really something that we should push the society, you gotta take more risk, go after it, you'll succeed. It's not the way it works. But if you get people prepared through these activities, et cetera, they will understand that more things are possible, and they will have a mindset to search for the solutions. As I said before, I think entrepreneurs are problem solvers. So usually if you'd ask a lot of entrepreneurs, do you take a lot of risks in your business? They'll say, probably not. But for an outsider, they took tremendous risk. But they tried to cover their bases to decrease the risk as much as they could.
Right.
I just had some thoughts about this whole business of trying to quantify entrepreneurs. And I'm pushing 60 and grew up in the culture where women weren't really expected to do a whole lot except sort of things that were women's roles. And I grew up in a pretty supportive family, but one of the things that I never was burdened by was this whole notion of having a business plan for my life, where I was going to be a doctor, or I was going to be a lawyer, whatever. I was sort of told I could be anything that I wanted to be. And I think that was actually a real benefit because I've had multiple careers, very odd things. I went from being a human biologist to an anthropologist to securities analyst to an investment banker to a CFO of a startup to a CEO of a startup to consulting, and now I'm taking photographs and running a ranch and doing some other things. But I think part of it was being open to opportunities that weren't sort of stuck in some little fixed line of where I was supposed to go. And I had a lot of people say to me, well, what does that have to do with anthropology? I said, an anthropologist is somebody who's kind of open to all different ways of doing things and different cultural views. And I'm an anthropologist I used to joke that I was doing field studies in investment banking as an anthropologist. But I think this sort of non-linear approach to identifying opportunities and going with it is a subset of the risk-taking thing. And I agree with you that, you know, risk takers aren't just jumping off the high dive and wondering whether there's water in the pool. They actually start getting some confidence that they can be dropped into situations that are completely foreign to them. I was talking to a young woman earlier. I started everywhere at point B, not knowing what point A was, but I had confidence that I could go back and learn A to B. And I've been modestly successful at that. I'm not Bill Gates, but there's a lot of opportunity for people if they just can open up the idea that they're not on a linear path.
For sure. All innovation is nonlinear. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Bob Goff. I'm an expatriate of Silicon Valley and currently a angel capitalist in green technology, primarily up at Lake Tahoe. And last week, I attended the Intel-sponsored and Kaufman-supported International Science and Engineering Fair, and there were 1,600 ninth to 12th graders all across the nation, all across the world. I think there were some 50 some countries represented there. But to the extent that we have innovation and education is one of the foundations, or two of the foundations of entrepreneurship, it seems to me that the experiments that they were showing, demonstrating up there in Reno last week, were some of them were truly inspired. And if there was a way to connect those ninth and 12th graders into mentors or into some kind of a bridge of what commercialization possibilities were that downstream, I think that's part of the solution of what could be done. The other one that the other area that occurs to me is, you know, angel capital networks such as ours do primarily three things. We provide coaching, capital, and connectivity. And most of the members and our mentors who have been successful who love coaching entrepreneurs. So my question is, to what extent does the perhaps American-led angel capital networking, to what extent is that being formed and expanded internationally, globally? And is there more that we can do in both those science and engineering-like fairs and coupling them in with the mentoring and the networking that can be done both virtually as well as in person to accelerate entrepreneurship, successful entrepreneurship around the world?
Good question.
Well, I know one. I mean, I think that's going to angels first and maybe backing up to some of the other themes that you touched upon. I think it is peculiarly American. I don't know, Secretary Rice's comments, certainly talking about the common culture, which is still the common culture, and I hope the Kauffman Foundation can continue it being the common culture of optimism. But I think clearly there's something here that from the Netherlands, I can say, doesn't exist in Western Europe, and is one of the reasons why many Europeans or other people in the world do admire the United States of this. This volunteerism after your success, et cetera. There are a couple of groups, New Vantage, et cetera, that's trying to pass that. Obviously, there's cultural differences. You have to try to be able, both on language, et cetera, to communicate it. But if you're reasonably in the technology, I think there are people, TriLink or InvestLink, there's some groups who've done what you're saying, really getting, particularly medium-scale entrepreneurs. I'm not sure about this billion-dollar stuff. I think there's lots of roles for $100 million companies. I mean, you know, and I think I think there are a lot of $100 million type entrepreneurs who are frankly super and who, after they've cashed out or sold out or whatever else, that part of the journey is better left in somebody else's hands, are very ready to give of their time and maybe some of their money, but mostly their. And I think that is something that should be expanded, and I think a great ambassadorial role for Americans. So that's certainly that point. I think it kind of ties in with the lady rancher, investment banker, anthropologist. I think one of the real problems that we have in the U.S., I love that. I love what you're doing, because you're doing whatever you can do the best of it. If something else comes up and it seems more leveraged for you to do that, do that. Now, that's almost the essence of an entrepreneur or a serial entrepreneur, let's say. I think the problem I see in places like less maybe Stanford Business School than Harvard Business School, et cetera. We had a couple of Harvard Business School people love what we were doing. I want to join CIF, you know, I want to go do this, et cetera. And when you interview them and when you try to understand what their DNA is, it's incredibly important to them that they don't fail. I mean, you know, they've done all the right schools, their parents have got them all the right way, this sort of programming that starts when you're six or whatever, so that you might make the right private school to make the right whatever it is. I think that's really so detrimental to the United States. You know, I think if kids can do, And if parents, more importantly, can let them do what they're good at, you know, you're blessed to have been a woman so that you're, I don't know, if your father was somebody who says you got to be a doctor as a kid or whatever. I mean, I think that's terrible. And nowhere more do I see that with Harvard MBA schools. I don't want to pick on that, but Harvard MBA guys, it matters more to them what their classmates are doing than what they're doing. You know, they're going to be calling up every sort of, and the social networking has made that almost worse because, you know, if what do you report? You report success, right? So all of a sudden, Jim, I mean, that guy was a moron and now he's making, you know, and you know, all of a sudden people get out of their own mission and they get into this comparative, you know, well, if he's doing it, why don't I do it? And I'd say that's just a fount of a lot of unhappiness. So, I mean, one of the things that we, you know, as a trying to promote entrepreneurial culture should really do is to really respect people who do things, not just talk about them, I think, but really, because I think on the risk side, I completely agree with you. I don't think any of our guys are saying, wow, what little risk can I, and I'm sure that was not what the comment was, but I think the whole notion is they actually see, well, this is leverage for me to do. I mean, that's really what they're doing. This is the best I can do with my time at this stage, and they take a joy in actually executing it. I mean, there's lots of people I've seen who take a joy in talking about it, but I mean, so somehow, how can we do that respect? How can we really, you know, that's the thing.
Right.
Well, I have to salt a coda on that. You know, it's marvelous that now I understand why we run MBA schools, to teach people to be risk averse, okay? I just wanted to say that, you know, you said you became an anthropologist, and I'm right behind you. I was trained as an economist, and I've been so embarrassed lately being introduced that way. I've started to declare myself an anthropologist, so we'll talk.
So are you an anthropologist or an economist?
We'll talk One last point that's very important to the topic that caused you to ask your question, namely risk aversion. You know, we have the sense that people who create businesses, be they small business, large businesses, do it in some moment right around school, and it just happens. That's at Stanford, right? You know, the average age of the person who starts the Inc. 500 fastest growing firms in the United States is 40. 40. Okay, so it happens, you know, it happens all over. And we have people who teach it in business school as if it's the prodigy syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, if you haven't done it by the time you're 21, you know, you better take that job at IBM.
The insurance company.
Yeah.
Right. There.
I started a nonprofit in Singapore 7 years ago to encourage entrepreneurism when they were saying there are no entrepreneurs. But it seems to me the bias I heard at that time, their idea of an entrepreneur was Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. And it sounds a little like that's your idea of an entrepreneur, that, you know, they got to be big. And I must tell you, we interview entrepreneurs and then create a book. And the first entrepreneur we interviewed was a cobbler. And he had one employee, and he operated on the street. And the idea was just start. Because the kids there, we have a Confucian society and Lee Kuan Yew telling you what to do, don't think of challenging the norm. So we're saying, you know, get out and just do something. And if I used to quote this, and maybe Kaufman can correct me, but I said that if Singapore had the same number of small businesses to large that California does, they'd have a third bigger GDP. So would you?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a good thing you ask us that question, because I, like everybody else, not everybody else, I don't want to pull everybody into the sink with me, but you could hear my remarks and say we're celebrating people who do the big, huge startups, and nothing could be further from the truth. You've said it perfectly. Mm-hmm. You know, the person who creates the $100 million company, and for a lot of people, that's much too big. You know, the person who creates a company that employs 15 mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. is truly an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. It may be the sector, it may be the geographic locale, it may be the personality, it may be lots of things. But every entrepreneur, by the way, because somebody's already asked me about this at lunch, you know, the reason I never leave Kansas City is because people ask me questions like this. What's your position on social entrepreneurship? And generally, you know, my reaction is upright. My real reaction gets me in trouble sometimes. But it is every entrepreneur is a social entrepreneur. You know, every entrepreneur brings something out of nothing, which is the French definition of what entrepreneur is. It's really magic. You make something out of nothing. Most importantly, they create jobs. And then, second most importantly, they create wealth. All the new jobs in the United States are created in firms less than 5 years old. If we didn't have them, we'd have massive unemployment. And most of those jobs are not in companies that are going to become billion-dollar companies. Right. They're in companies that are going to have, when they're mature and hugely successful, they're going to have 55 people.
Yeah. I just want to take an answer as well. We don't mean that either you create a Google or you fail. I think that's the wrong notion of at least what we're saying here. However, if we help every entrepreneur to raise their bar, they can achieve a little bit more, if they can, instead of hiring one person, well, they're not doing that for hiring people, but if they can grow their business a little bit, it could have a low ceiling, and that's fine. But everybody should push to improve every year, and I think that's really, really important. And especially in developing markets, I think people settle too low. So the bar is low, nobody raises the bar for them, and nobody pushes them to achieve more. So it doesn't mean that 100% is going to be Google, Sergey, or Bill Gates, and the rest is out of the game. But it does mean that we should push people to achieve their full potential. And usually, it's far more than what they're doing. So I think we do have a role. And in that sense, we tend to use sometimes the big stories to sort of inspire them. But we also tend to look for local stories because, you know, a kid looking at the TV and looking at Bill Gates, he's not going to say, well, I'm going to be that guy. It's just too far out. So we do have to have some role models that are much, much closer to him. Somebody who employs one person, two people, somebody who's done something interesting within the community. And that is really something that they can relate to. And then they can challenge themselves to do more. So I think this is really an important part of what we do.
It sounds like that's what you're doing in Singapore too, right? Yep. So good for you. Yep.
Well, I came here today without any thought of being an entrepreneur, and I don't think I am. But let me speak for the idiot who does something out there and is successful. And then let me talk about the small person who makes something work. So I'll help you define this thing. First of all, I just don't think you can define an entrepreneur. I certainly didn't think I was one. And then I began thinking as I sat here, and I listened to all of you gentlemen who are well-educated and very successful, and I thought, you know, damn it all. What have I? Maybe I am. Maybe there's something to help this definition. Number one, the British are leaving Kenya in 1960, and they're all leaving. And I happened to be there, and I convinced a professional hunter to stay with me. We'd be a rancher. Well, we went from 3,000 acres to 1,560,000 in about 20 years. It was a few thousand dollars, and then I'm a lawyer. So somebody had an idea about a printing company. I said, yeah, sure, you need $1,000, I'll do it. Well, I got a printing company now. What I found is that an entrepreneur may be somebody who has some push for somebody else who's got a good idea, and he pushes. And then I go back to the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps told me that it doesn't matter if you have a good idea or a bad idea. A good idea with sort of a halfway push behind is not worth it. The wrong solution, high diddle-diddle, straight up the middle. Schultz here? He knows what I'm talking about. That's more important than a good idea. So what you got is this funny situation where you don't have anyone who's educated for it. You have an accident that you push somebody. And I found that the ability to recognize someone who's got talent. I was a lawyer, so I'm practicing law. I haven't got time to do these things. But I picked a professional hunter in Africa. I picked a young guy who wanted to do a printing company. I picked somebody who wanted to do water wells, and we discovered geothermal in Hawaii. I had nothing to do with it, but I pushed it. So that, do I qualify as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, BC. Okay. I think you're BC.
Over there?
Very successful.
Her, over there?
Hi, I'm Elena Connor. I'm the senior editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review, which is actually in your bags, and some of you have written for us. Dr. Schwamm has written for us, I think even in the issue that's in your bag. Please write for us. We're the Harvard Business Review for good, not evil, as we say. So I look around and I can't help but notice that the male to female ratio in this room is roughly 5-1. And that's not inherently bad. I mean, there wasn't a line for the bathroom for once. I'm a single woman, you know, it's all good. But I'm wondering if you think that's a problem, that generally entrepreneurs are seen as male and not female. And I mean, maybe you don't think that's a problem. And generally, do you think it should be a priority to promote female entrepreneurs abroad and here? Why or why not? And what would that entail?
Cern, do you want to try that one? How about your experience?
I do think this is a problem. And I agree with you. I think we are always making a concerted effort. And I cannot agree with you more. A lot needs to be done. This is something that we encourage our chapters all over the world to try to do a better job of. And frankly, right leadership can make a difference. For example, for the first time, we have a chapter in Denver, Colorado. Probably the only place I have to tell you, and it's a real surprise to me, why Denver? We have the largest percentage of female members, charter members, including a president of the chapter who happens to be a woman. So all I can tell you is that we have a lot of work to do in this area.
As a statistical matter, women start businesses at about the same rate in the United States as men. The issue is size of the business at the end of the trail. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. But if I could I go back to your characterization of your journal? The Harvard Business Review for Good and Not Evil, was that what you said? It brings to mind something that I visit with the audience about. I have read endless numbers of times, as I'm sure you have. There's a story in the local newspaper. Joe Blow sold his company. He took home a check for $400 million. And they interviewed Joe, and he said, what are you going to do? Now, this is an entrepreneur. This tells you how broke our system is mentally. It's the mental attitude. And more often than not, Joe says, well, now I'm going to do some good. Mm-hmm. All right? And, you know, that is pathetic in the sense, if you go back to what I just said in answer to that man's question, every entrepreneur is a social entrepreneur. They bring forth the new. They create jobs. Okay? They give dignity to other people mm-hmm. by giving them a job. In the case of Ewing Kaufman, in the case of John Rockefeller, they wrote about the greatest return to them psychologically was not their great foundations. It was the firm they started that they gave a job to. And both of them came from desperate poverty. You know, there was a time in their life when they didn't know where their next meal was coming from, and then to look into a factory and into a company where there were 10,000 people working because of their, mm-hmm. their you know, entrepreneurial drive. It was a huge psychic return to them. And then, of course, they create all the wealth. And the Kauffman Foundation wouldn't exist. No foundations would exist. There'd be no nonprofit sector but for the creation of wealth at the hands of entrepreneurs. It's the only way we know how to do it. And we will discover someday that notwithstanding our momentary systems of disbelief or suspensions of disbelief, the government can't create wealth. Okay? Only business can create wealth. And not all business does it well, and not all business does it in a morally acceptable way. But most entrepreneurs, I think actually in many regards, the entrepreneurs that we watch, I think it's often because they're closer to the market and the raw rules of the market. I think younger companies, in an odd way, partly because of Mansur Olson's business, they don't start manipulating the government. They don't have the capacity to manipulate the government. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can say they're more honest, but the purity or the morality of most young companies, at least measured by the market, is at a higher level than lots of older companies that basically go into the government seeking rents.
Mm-hmm. Great point. Back there?
Yeah, my name's Ted Dintersmith, and I've spent most of my career in venture capital. And I'd be interested in the panelists' comments on, when it comes to entrepreneurship abroad, the cultural issues around the sharing of equity and control. Because, I mean, my firm's backed, we must have backed 500 companies. We've never backed a company where every employee didn't own shares. And we always have a board structure where you've got the founder, the CEO, and then you've got several very qualified, interested parties. And when it works, it doesn't always work well, but when it works well, you've got some very motivated people, each with some ownership position in the company, working hard to make it a success. And my sense is, from my experience in the developing world, that's not, you know, a layup to get that concept across.
It takes a lot longer. I mean, what we have done is we've backed some companies that we've been in for more than 10 years, which, I mean, again, I get back to the structure. for SMEs to grow them before the entrepreneur first gets trust with you as a third-party investor, and then for you to begin to really say, hey, we really ought to motivate the important people and ESOPs kind of issues, which is second nature here. People come and employ, and they ask, how can I get into an ESOP? Two things. One is that stock isn't necessarily perceived to be that valuable in a lot of these countries, Uzbekistan or Poland or Peru or whatever. People don't even know what it is, right? They're just looking for the Christmas bonus. But when you get into where the companies on a transparent reporting basis and where people can see, I mean, we've done ESOPs in a couple of companies after a long time to where people really are really interested in seeing every month, well, what's the EBITDA look like at this stage to the extent that they're own stock. So I think part of the reason is that there isn't an active capital market. B, for the SME side, the culture of getting trust beyond the entrepreneur does take time. And I think with time, the same desire to get co-ownership and to get people to be aligned in the interest of the same way does exist. But the education process is a lot longer, and culturally, depending upon which country, it takes much longer. I mean, interestingly, we were in Afghanistan and some Central Asian countries, and there the whole Islamic financing has a participatory element to it. And you can actually, to some extent, distinguish yourself from high interest bearing, even the micros that are charging 50% or whatever interest. You can actually distinguish yourself by emphasizing this participatory nature to the extent that the entrepreneur is willing to share that down. And we certainly try to push it for the key people. It works. But at the employee level, they don't understand it. And it's probably not really, you know, without a capital market, I don't know.
Good afternoon. My name is Herbir Bhatia, and I've had the pleasure to meet some of you already. I have a career that is just, you know, the typical, you go to work, you do what you do, and I've been doing fine in that. But I've always had the desire to become a full-time entrepreneur and be a serial entrepreneur like many of you here today. So first of all, thank you for all of you coming, because you've given us a lot of hope. And Janice has spoken about her initiatives. The thing we keep talking about is, you know, money. But for those of us that have been sitting on, you know, the line saying, you know what, I want to become that entrepreneur, but we're lost in that, I'm not sure who mentioned it, that, oh, you know, if you don't become the entrepreneur at 21, now what? Okay, can't happen to me. But the fact is, it's happening, right? So it's not always about the cash, because $400 million of support, I'd be like, oh my God, that's a lot of money. We don't even need that, to be honest. The question I have for you is that, do we understand what that process is to becoming an entrepreneur? Can somebody tell me from your points of view, all the learnings, what do you believe that process is? And now, with all the experience and the support you have by your supporting organizations, what do we do to enable that entrepreneur through that process? Because when you have that idea, and that idea becomes the right idea, the funding will come. But to get to that stage, that is a very huge gap that I'm not getting, I guess, the answers I'm looking for, and the wisdom that maybe you can share with us. So first part of that question is, what are those phases we're talking about? I have a blimp, I have an idea. Okay, I can sleep on it never happened. Next, do I share my idea? Do I evaluate that idea? Where do we as an ecosystem get involved before the cash comes into the picture? Because the cash will come if the idea is right. So that's the second part. Thank you for my question.
Okay, so there are a lot of answers to that one.
Could I start? Because I think you really ask us the acid test question. You know, how does this happen? And let me try an answer, but I'll try it again in opposition to the received wisdom. If you go to certain universities right now, virtually all universities, and you ask your question, they're going to say, okay, the first thing I want to teach you is, quote, opportunity recognition. Because that's what we'll teach you first before we teach you how to write the business plan, right? And you've actually got your thumb on exactly this issue about what you're really asking is, when is the idea coming to me? How do I test the idea, and what would be the natural progression or the progression I can oversee and manipulate and form towards the point at which this could become a business or won't become a business, okay? And I like to call that the proto-business plan stage. And when I speak now, I speak actually informed by a long process now underway for 3 years at Kauffman, which is sort of the gene code of what will become Kauffman Laboratories for Enterprise Creation. And what we're trying to do is actually attack the issue of who becomes an entrepreneur. So for the first time, I think, in history, we will be in the business of actually recruiting people into entrepreneurship. That doesn't happen. And I, by the way, I believe, just as a moral equation issue, when you don't recruit people into entrepreneurship, you are at liberty to advance all kinds of untested ideas. Okay? That's a very important issue. It's one of the reasons I think the epistemology of entrepreneurship doesn't ever get settled, because people volunteer to hear what you have to say. You don't ask them in. It changes the equation totally. The question then is, what process do you go through with people, and how do you support them as they iterate ideas to the point where they have an idea that's tested? Okay, our vision about when you get out of Kauffman Labs as a recruited entrepreneur, you don't get a fixed diploma at 3 months or 3 years. You come out when you have a company that someone's ready to invest in. That's the hurdle. Now, if you reverse engineer the process of business formation from that moment, you actually get into exactly your type of question. And you've touched the right question.
I would say, too, that Carl started that theme with his first comments, is the process of innovation, I think, is something that needs to be more broadly understood. I wrote a book about it called Innovation. We teach everybody at my company the process of innovation. It's a very learnable thing. There are steps you go through. It's not magic. I almost never use the word entrepreneur because it frankly scares a lot of people. But there are an enormous number of people who want to be innovators, people who want to make a contribution, who want to do things that really matter to other people to make a difference. So I always start out with, you know, this sense of achievement that so many people have. How do we help you achieve more with your life? How do we help you make a bigger impact? And the point that Carl keeps on making about entrepreneurs, let's use that word, being the people who really make the big contribution to society. If we were thinking about this properly, we would celebrate those people.
I totally agree with that, but I do want to say that, I mean, I think what Edison said, what is a invention is like 1% inspiration, 99% perseverance. I don't back ideas. I mean, I back people. I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, so what's the process? I think we can study the process. I think we can understand what some of the problems are so that you're more educated before you jump in the water. But I love this quote, so many good businesses begin at 40. These are normally frustrated middle management guys at chemistry, you know, and the chemical concern has just been pissing on them for years. And finally they said, I'm nuts with you guys. I'm going to go off and do it. And those guys both have the depth of understanding what the market is. And then they have the inbuilt frustration and creativity that I know they're going to work. So even without a lot of skin in the game, they're just absolutely, you know, driving their ego on the mast, and we're going to sail into those seas, and they're going to be rough seas. But what I really want to say is not because people are well educated here. I'm frightened of ideas to the exclusion of animal instincts or perseverance or ego.
So I'd like to say thanks to our panel and to you. I would like to say you have already started. I look forward to seeing you in 10 years with your successful company. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Ashkan Jafari.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.